This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner says he does not see a problem with his department writing far more speeding tickets than Bloomington police do.
In the number of fatalities that we have or we don't have, it's nothing that I'm going to apologize for. I think it's certainly something that we would tout.
GLT's Mary Cullen and Ryan Denham suss out the hot spots for speeding tickets in the Twin Cities and tell you where they are. Plus, Eric Stock reports on the social media buzz that gave an ordinary child custody case a lot of legs, the case of little Mikey Cadena. And John Norton has the music of the Bottle Rockets. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you've lived in Bloomington Normal long enough, you can probably rattle off at least a couple speed traps, those little hiding spots where local police always set up shop looking for speeders. A new GLT analysis of speeding tickets reveals all of the most ticketed intersections in town, plus the most common days and times to get a ticket. But as Ryan Denham and Mary Cullen report, what all those tickets also show is two neighboring police departments with very different approaches to enforcement.
You don't need to tell Glenda Jackson that people drive too fast on Hershey Road. She already knows. She's a crossing guard for Stevenson Elementary School on Bloomington's east side, spending 2 hours every day helping kids at Hershey and Arrowhead Drive. That's one of the most ticketed intersections in Bloomington Normal for speeding. Jackson has seen lots of people pull over and plenty of close calls as her students try to cross the street.
And it could be because it's like a winding road and perhaps the motorists think they're on a raceway rather than a regular road. You know, I think they just like going around that those curves.
Hershey is one of the hottest hotspots in Bloomington Normal for speeding tickets, according to a GLT analysis of citations from local police. That same analysis shows different approaches to speeding by Bloomington Police and Normal Police. Normal Police write a lot of tickets, over 2,600 last year, and they're on a similar pace in 2018. That's 10 times as many as Bloomington Police. Normal's 2017 tally was also higher than other larger downstate metro communities such as Springfield, Peoria, and Decatur. Bloomington Police wrote 274 tickets in 2017. That's less than one per day. That's a steep decline from just 10 years ago when BPD would write over 2,400 each year. That was before Bloomington eliminated its traffic enforcement division.
GLT's analysis of local speeding tickets shows if you're driving in Normal, definitely obey the speed limit during the noon hour on Wednesdays, especially on Main Street between the entrance to Fairview Park and Gregory Street. Those are the most frequently ticketed time, day, and location in Normal.
Six of the top 10 most ticketed locations in Bloomington are on Hershey Road, led by its intersections with Arrowhead, Ridge, and Morningside.
And the speediest speeder stopped by Bloomington Police appears to be someone caught around 4:30 in the afternoon, February 9th this year, at White Eagle and Sable Oaks in a residential area near Gaelic Park on the far east side. That driver was allegedly going 80 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone.
Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner says Normal Police's traffic division includes two officers at a time. Each work 4 10-hour shifts, so the town has officers devoted to traffic from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. throughout the week.
I don't think traffic safety is anything that we should apologize for. I think the fact that we, when we look at it year in and year out, and the number of fatalities that we have or we don't have, we have a relatively low number compared to other agencies. It's nothing that I'm going to apologize for. I think it's certainly something that we would tout.
Bleichner says 50% of drivers stopped are not Bloomington Normal residents. A quarter live in Bloomington, and the rest are residents of Normal. He says drivers caught going less than 10 miles per hour over tend to get a verbal warning.
Once you get over 10 mile an hour, you know, it's like 8 or 9-year fine, 10-year mine, you're going to probably get a ticket.
So what are Normal's most ticketed areas?
From 2017 up through August 31st of this year, number one on the list is not a shocker. 700 North Main Street between Fairview Park and Illinois State University, where almost 350 speeding tickets were given out. It's about 8% of all speeding tickets from Normal. It's also a hotspot for Illinois State University police. Its top three most ticketed intersections are all in that area, too.
Another one is College Avenue near Epiphany Catholic Church, approximately between William and Blair Drives.
And Vernon Avenue near Anthony Drive. That's where Vernon curves, just east of Colleen Hoos Elementary School. Here's Chief Bleichner.
We look at the locations where crashes occur and the types, the causes that contribute to those crashes. And then we also look at factors that either contribute to the crash or contribute to the severity. And that's my opinion on speeding would be that speeding does both.
Bleichner says his department's data show focusing enforcement efforts in high crash areas reduces crashes.
That's what we attempt to do. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't certain violations that are written that aren't tied to areas where we're having crashes, but we try and focus a lot of our efforts on locations where crashes are occurring. So our goal is to, if we see a spike, we address that as timely as we can so that we can hopefully curb that.
He says as a result, the spikes in speeding ticket hotspots will change over time. Two areas Bleichner says are almost always in the top five are Main Street and Veterans Parkway.
There's a heavy flow of vehicle traffic on that. Plus, we have a fair amount of traffic crashes in those locations. So from our standpoint, if we can direct some enforcement efforts in those locations, our hope is that we're slowing people down. Again, hopefully reducing the number of crashes. And if there are crashes, reducing the severity of those crashes.
Bloomington police officials also say crash data guide their enforcement decisions, though it led them to a different approach than Normal. BPD's Traffic Enforcement Division was eliminated about 8 years ago to free up resources for other police priorities. Police data show the drop in speeding citations was sudden. In 2009, BPD issued nearly 2,800 tickets. By 2010, that fell to just 530. These days, Bloomington Police Assistant Chief Ken Bays says enforcement is largely guided by complaints. If a neighborhood has concerns, BPD can deploy a speed display sign that not only spooks drivers into slowing down, but also gathers data on the worst days and times of the week. BPD can later use that to deploy ticket writers at the most opportune times. Officers can also check out radar guns whenever they have time.
When you get a speeding ticket, typically you pay at least a $120 fine. Normal and Bloomington's different approaches to speeding tickets means they bring in different amounts of revenue. That exact revenue is difficult to track because neither municipality or the McLean County Circuit Clerk's office reports just speeding ticket revenue. In 2017, Normal received around $478,000 in revenue from the courts, including speeding tickets, but also other court fines unrelated to speeding. Bloomington received $272,000, down 45% from a decade ago when the Traffic Enforcement Division still existed. Those numbers come from McLean County Circuit Clerk Don Everhart.
Ken Bays says BPD's current strategy on speeding is informed heavily by data. He says they haven't seen any major uptick in the number of crashes even without the Traffic Enforcement Division. There were about 2,000 accidents in 2017 and about the same number in 2007. Here's Bays.
You know, if we see an uptick in crashes as we monitor them, then we may have to reconsider how we're allocating our resources. But I said, with no real drastic or huge change in the amount of crashes compared to the amount of enforcement, I think we're best serving the public and their safety concerns by the allocations as we're doing currently.
Officials say restoring a traffic enforcement division could cost $500,000, upwards of $750,000.
Looking at justifying an expenditure of roughly $750,000 to fully staff one to have an impact on a stagnant number of crashes where the injury and things occur, I don't know if that's the proper use of resources when compared to some of the other issues that we deal with on a daily basis.
Bays argues that BPD's limited budget and officers better spent focused on more serious crimes. He says that philosophy has contributed to four straight years of decline in so-called UCR or Uniform Crime Report offenses in Bloomington. Those are serious crimes, including homicides, sexual assault, robbery, and theft.
This year's increase in fatal shootings has kept Bloomington officers busy. Seven people have been killed by gunfire in 2018, including one this week, and eight others were shot and survived.
Bloomington Alderman Diana Howman says she was a little surprised to hear how few speeding tickets were being issued. Her Ward 8 includes parts of Hershey Road, which she said she's a little hesitant to cross herself on foot because of the traffic. Howman says Bloomington police are responsive to concerns when they do arise.
I mean, without the traffic division, our officers are, you know, pulled in a whole lot of different directions.
There are efforts underway to reduce excessive speeding in Bloomington's residential areas, though nearly everyone involved says police enforcement isn't a top priority. Several ideas are pending before Bloomington Transportation Commission.
Serena Fish lives near the main entrance to Miller Park. She said drivers fly down Wood Street, where there are no designated stoppages between Center Street and Morris Avenue.
Children or people walking, riding their bikes, with their dogs, their kids, their strollers. People tend to come down Wood Street and hit the gas. And in the summertime, it's really, I don't know if they're trying to impress people in the park, but all of a sudden the noise level goes up, the speed goes up.
Fish says she'd like to see the city create a designated pedestrian crossing in the area, perhaps tied to a stop sign with flashing lights to improve safety. But she doesn't necessarily want to see a massive increase in police writing speeding tickets.
Right now we have some other much more important things, I think, in this city to take care of, crime-wise.
The Bloomington Transportation Commission this fall evaluated six options to address speeding that may be recommended to the City Council to consider. Two options have already been ruled out, including restoration of Bloomington Police's Traffic Enforcement Division. That's according to Transportation Commission Chair Michael Gorman.
The Bloomington Police Department is wildly understaffed. I think the city's budget issues are well documented, and you know, to add a traffic enforcement division that we had before would cost about $750,000, and that's a very expensive proposition at this time.
Instead, Gorman says he wants to see streets redesigned in a way that drivers would slow themselves down. He points to Bryan Street and Normal as an aspirational redesign. It's a bike boulevard with bump outs or curb extensions at most intersections.
And what that means is that when you're driving down the street, you feel more inclined to come to a complete stop. You feel like the street is just ever so slightly less comfortable to drive really fast on, which ends up curbing people's speed a little bit and making it more safe for people outside of cars. So looking at opportunities to do that sort of thing in targeted neighborhoods across Bloomington, I think, is one of the things that we're still looking at.
Gorman cites research that he says shows a 90% survival rate when a pedestrian, a bicyclist, is struck by a car going 20 miles an hour. That drops to just 10% if the car is going 40.
If you design streets well and make sure that people are going to drive at a safe speed, then you don't need much enforcement.
Alderman Karen Schmidt from Ward 6 says residential speeding is a key issue for her and her constituents, including Fish. She initiated the commission's work on the issue.
I've been to communities around the country where when you're a pedestrian, when you step out into the street, cars stop. I think Washington, D.C. is wait a minute, they just stopped for me. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily, we're more of a vehicle culture. You know, so how do we create the community that we want when it comes to, you know, our families, our neighborhoods?
Gorman says another option that's largely been ruled out is reducing the city's default speed limit from 30 to 25 miles per hour. He says the commission may still recommend creating a process for certain neighborhoods to request that, but a citywide approach didn't gain traction. Brad Williams likes that idea. He's the president of the Dimmitt's Grove Neighborhood Association and brought his concerns to Schmidt. Williams points to Front Street, where he said he's seen drivers going 50 miles per hour, taking advantage of its wide design and few stoppages.
We're not talking about slowing traffic down on Veterans Parkway and other areas, just in residential areas and places where there's a lot of people, a lot of pedestrian traffic. It needs to slow down.
Ken Bays from Bloomington Police says it's unclear whether a citywide change from 30 to 25 would actually slow things down. Those who break the law might just continue to do so.
And I think ultimately, yes, it would be very challenging for us.
A similar neighborhood-driven change happened in 2017. That's when speed limits were reduced from 40 and 35 miles an hour down to 30 on the north end of Hershey Drive, generally between Rainbow Avenue and Fort Jesse Road. That change was supported by residents of the nearby Spring Ridge neighborhood and their alderman, Johnny Painter. Painter declined to be interviewed for this story. That's one of the reasons why so many tickets are given on Hershey Road today. Crossing guard Glenda Jackson sees that every day. She lives in the area, too. She's gotten to know the Bloomington police officer who's most often there on Hershey writing tickets.
He is phenomenal. He catches those speeders left and right. And there, I mean, I've seen him do as many as catch three or four speeders in the 1 hour that I'm there on the corner in the morning.
Reporting for GLT, I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mary Cullen.
You can see an interactive map showing the most ticketed intersections in Bloomington Normal at our website, WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Credit Union, providing big city convenience with local friendly service. Member owned and highly involved in the community, Mid-Illini puts people before profits. Mid-Illini Credit Union, where different is better. Details at MidIlliniCU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's hard to believe that it's been 10 years since the FBI knocked on the door of then-Governor Rod Blagojevich. We'll have a story in just a moment. Most of what happens in McLean County courtrooms never makes the news. Aside from the occasional high-profile criminal trial, media don't report on most of the cases. But a recent McLean County child custody case has attracted headlines. It involves a bitter legal battle between parents who both have criminal records, threats against a judge, and videos that have gone viral. GLT's Eric Stock examines how the case of 4-year-old Mikey Cadena became such a phenomenon, what it says about our legal system, and what it says about our media culture.
Mikey Cadena's mother recently regained her child after a legal struggle dating back to shortly after Amber Buck gave birth to Mikey Cadena. Pantograph newspaper reporter Edith Brady Lunny says she started following the case in 2016 when police arrested Amber Buck on charges she helped her former boyfriend run a methamphetamine lab in their Bloomington apartment. The state removed her two children from her care. Buck pleaded guilty to felony drug charges. She received a sentence of probation after Buck convinced McLean County Judge Robert Freitag that she had turned her life around. Brady Lunny says she believes the fact that Buck was a mother of two young children might have influenced the judge's decision to keep her out of prison.
The fact that she wanted to be a parent again, I think, was a factor in her favor, and it was one of the components of the probation that he wanted to see if she could do that.
Brady Lunny adds most women in prison have children and judges try to avoid separating children from mothers. Pantograph coverage of the case continued this year when the father tried to gain custody of the boy. Michael Cadena filed for custody in 2014. He left Illinois with the boy without the court's permission in March 2017 and went back to live in Massachusetts. He refused to attend multiple child custody hearings with his son. McLean County Associate Judge Leanne Hill held Cadena in contempt of court and sentenced him to 6 months in jail. Massachusetts police arrested Michael Cadena in early October and retrieved the boy to reunite him with his mother. If Cadena wishes to pursue his custody case in Illinois, he will likely face arrest, though his attorneys are appealing the contempt order and are trying to move the case to federal court. Once those stories were posted online on the Pantograph's website and elsewhere, they took on a life of their own. Other websites picked up the case, mostly through social media shares. It went viral. Nate Carpenter runs the Social Media Analytics and Command Center, or SMAC Lab, at Illinois State University. He studies and teaches social media trends. Carpenter considers it unique that a local story with fairly minimal news coverage snowballed into a story that attracted so much online attention.
I guess it's not odd that it doesn't get picked up in other national level papers, yet sees a tremendous amount of social media coverage. And what may be interesting, that we may see the social media coverage get it national attention.
So how did it happen? A number of online blogs and other websites in Illinois and beyond picked up the story and amplified it. Sites such as BLNnews.com, Massachusetts Reddit, and a site called Turtle Boy Sports, to name a few. Carpenter was particularly amused to see 332,000 have viewed a video of Little Mikey at the police station on one website, World Star Hip Hop. How do stories like this spread? Carpenter says computer algorithms connect web content to viewers who are most likely to be interested in watching.
There are a whole lot of people talking about that. And again, YouTube's also connected to Google. And if you have a Google account and you've been surfing the web and you have particular interests, a lot of people with your same interests who might be watching that video, whatever they're watching will now show up as a video that's promoted just for you.
Kadena's father was trying to exploit the viral nature of the story to win back custody of the boy, claiming the mom has been abusing the boy, producing videos on YouTube.
Please stick with us on this fight. We got to get Mikey home. The longer he's gone, the more dangerous it is. We're hearing stories going back and forth.
And Michael Kadena isn't the only family member mixing in.
And I'm Mikey's Grammy. We are still fighting. We have to get him back.
The father has even started an online petition at change.org called Help Us Save Mikey. He's asking for donations to pay his legal expenses. Carpenter from the ISU Smack Lab warned viral videos and other online content pose a threat to our public discourse because it can so easily get caught up in a digital echo chamber, regardless of its accuracy.
If you find a video that's been viewed by, you know, millions of people, it kind of falls into this you know, fallacy of, you know, might makes right. And so, well, if a lot of people have seen this, therefore it's really powerful evidence that supports my side.
The attention has also attracted scrutiny of media coverage. The Pantograph's Edith Brady Lunny says she's received at least 30 emails from readers critical of her reporting.
I am surprised. I shouldn't be, because social media is just such an unpredictable universe that's kind of taken on a life of its own, you know, across not just this country, but all over the world.
Brady Lunny suggests news consumers have become more informed before drawing conclusions rather than relying on blogs and websites that are simply trying to push emotional buttons.
I wish they would read everything and be fully informed before they make opinions. And a lot of these people are just reading tidbits, and they're making opinions on the basis of emotion. You don't know what their personal life is. Maybe this story strikes a chord with them.
Todd Fust says he understands why the story has struck a chord with so many. Fust is an associate professor of sociology at Illinois Wesleyan University.
People with lots of different positions and points of view have a reason to feel angry about this case, and therefore want to share it, want to talk about it with their friends, want to kind of get in fights online over it, all of which is going to be that kind of activating emotion of anger that's going to cause people to share something like this.
While an overwhelming majority of readers and viewers sharing the online content have no personal connection to the case, Fust says the story and the police station video are compelling.
Do you see? I know, but do you see these good men? Do you see them? They're going to make sure that you're safe.
No. Regardless of how you feel about the veracity of the videos, they create a drama here, right? You know, there's one thing to read a dry newspaper article about, you know, a custody battle or a little boy who's upset. It's another thing to see a video of that little boy be upset.
Fust adds, for many, the case may be relatable to what people have experienced in their own lives.
It taps into existing narratives about the court system and existing narratives about criminal justice. Do you have a problem with the criminal justice system, with courts, with judges, with crime? If you have some kind of issue with that or some way you already think about that, that particularly one that's negative or that makes you angry, this case might stoke that.
As for the police station video, which shows Mikey visibly upset as he's being told he's going back to his mother, Fust says children are products of their environment.
When you're talking about a kid, the question kind of becomes, to what degree is it manipulation? To what degree is it what the kid knows? We all socialize our kids, right? And we all socialize our kids in ways that make sense to us.
Hust says the case of a seemingly distraught young boy plays into a media narrative that can distort reality. He draws a parallel to the way cable news has covered cases of missing women.
If you look at the actual kind of databases of missing women or missing people, and then compare it to who gets coverage, it is victims who are younger, more attractive, typically white, often blonde, because they are perceived as sympathetic. They are perceived as innocents in our society.
The problem, Fust says, is the picture the coverage paints doesn't always square with the reality. He says it's easy to do. He gives an example in his own classroom where he gives students in his criminology class false crime data.
Say crime has been doubling every year since 1980, and everyone goes, yeah, of course it has. And then I say, actually, of course it hasn't. It's been going down since 1980. We're at the lowest point in the crime rate since just about the 1960s. But no one believes that, because when you turn on the news, the first thing you see is a robbery tonight, a shooting today.
Media attention can also impact how an attorney prepares his case. Amber Buck's lawyer, Tristan Bullington, says he figured early on this child custody case was going to be different from all the others he had handled in his 9 years as an attorney.
From the get-go, when Mr. Cadena refused to return to the state of Illinois, it was clear at that point that this was no longer a typical case and was going to be something else.
Bullington says it's frustrating that cases like this require a strategy to win in the courtroom and in the court of public opinion, which plays out online.
That's not the way we do court hearings, and we're not going to do a court hearing over Facebook. We're not going to do a court hearing over YouTube videos. It's just wildly inappropriate to handle a hearing that way.
Bullington acknowledges it was tempting at times to refute what he saw online.
My initial reaction is I want to go in there and create an account at the various different social media sites where that's being shared and respond to every single message with what has actually happened. What I actually do is nothing, because it's not appropriate to go and share confidential information on the internet with people who really have no business being involved in this child's life.
Bullington dismisses claims by the Cadena family Buck has abused little Mikey. Bullington says he has tried to shield the boy from media scrutiny.
Let's assume that all of the things that are being said are true, which, again, I don't believe that to be the case. I still wouldn't want that out there about a child. That doesn't help the child at all. That doesn't keep him safer. That doesn't protect him. That just opens him up for bullying and harassment in the future.
Bullington says Buck has been threatened on various social media pages, but he noted they typically are taken down once reported. And he says that viral police station video of Mikey being told he's being reunited with his mother was evidently created and posted to sway public opinion in the father's favor.
I don't see any reason why that video would have been made, period, but for trying to garner support on the internet. And it's unfortunate that a lot of that has now been used for fundraising purposes to try and make money off of members of the public who don't know what's going on.
Bullington says he understands why many viewers have a strong reaction to the police station video where Mikey is told he's going home with his mother, but he says they can't get the facts unless they show up in court and get the facts from a hearing on the best interests of a minor child. Bullington has departed from his rule against responding publicly. He distributed a video to the media and to Mikey Cadena's family and friends, taken shortly after Mikey came back to Illinois with his mother. The clip shows Mikey at a playground and taking cookies to the police department in Massachusetts. Bullington says he took the videos down after a short time. He says they were solely to counter claims the boy was unhappy going with his mother.
I know some people have expressed concern that the video is staged, the video doesn't show enough information, the video doesn't show him playing with other children. No matter what we released, there was going to be criticisms of it. The point of the video was not to show everything. It was to respond to one particular point, which is that Mikey is fine. Leave us alone.
Bullington acknowledges Amber Buck's criminal past likely played a role in raising public sentiment against her. He suggests that is out of proportion.
From what they read, it comes across as 2 days ago, there was a meth house, and now the child is going back there. It couldn't be further from the truth. My client's been sober for over 2 years.
The case has drawn so much online vitriol, it led to threats against the judge who granted custody to the boy's mother. McLean County Sheriff John Sandage says his department has issued subpoenas to gain access to phone numbers where the threats originated. He says he doesn't expect to make any arrests.
Although a lot of these messages were somewhat harassing in nature, we have found that nothing is really prosecutable.
Sandage says the courts received vague references to violence, but no direct threats against the judge or anyone else. He says investigators warned those responsible their threats were borderline criminal. The courts also tightened security following the threats.
It's a sad situation that anybody would put a child in the middle like that. I will say that a majority of the issues we see in the courthouse as far as volatile issues are in our family courts.
Sandage says judges and public figures now need more protection from what he sees as growing public vitriol.
And I think a lot of it has to do with social media. There's more avenues for people to express their feelings now, and they're putting it out there, and sometimes it does cross the line.
Sandage says his office cannot regularly monitor social media, but does respond to complaints. Despite the time it takes to investigate online threats, Sandage says social media can make police work easier.
People like to brag, and usually in this day and age, the way they brag is going on social media.
Sandage says social media can also help identify someone in cases where they get only partial information at a crime scene. As for Mikey, attorney Tristan Bullington says the boy is getting psychological treatment and is doing well. He won't say where the family lives. Regardless of how the case plays out in court and in the media, Bullington says the custody struggle will be a part of the boy's life for years to come.
And that's what's been really unfortunate about this, is that evidence is out there, and that's something that this child is going to have to deal with for the rest of his life, since it's not going to disappear off the internet.
Michael Cadena's attorneys in Massachusetts and in Bloomington refused GLT's request to be interviewed for this story. I'm Eric Stock.
Judge Leon Hill announced plans in September to retire. Her last day on the bench is December 19th. This week, the new judge appointed in the case ordered the parents to begin setting up telephone visits between the father and son. This is 89.1 GLT at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an IPR report on career training as opposed to the common college track that's been the expected outcome for most high school students over the last several decades. This coming Sunday, December 9th, marks the 10th anniversary of the day the FBI arrested Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. The event led to his impeachment, his criminal conviction, and a 14-year prison sentence. There were also changes in state ethics laws. But there are those who say the corruption was not the worst part of the Blagojevich administration. Among them is IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, who makes that argument in this week's news analysis from Illinois Issues.
You know those events where people say, you'll always remember where you were when you heard the news? For anyone even remotely connected to Illinois government, December 9th, 2008 is one of those days.
I was in bed.
Jim Durkin represents Western Springs in the Illinois House.
My wife was in the adjoining bathroom with the TV on, and then she called me over and said, get over here, you got to see this.
We begin this hour with breaking news. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has been taken into federal custody.
The governor of Illinois, who ran for office promising reform,
was intercepted on court-authorized wiretaps conspiring to sell or trade the U.S. Senate seat left vacant by President-elect Barack Obama to the highest bidder.
The conduct would make Lincoln roll over in his grave. The governor's own words describing the Senate seat, quote, I've got this thing,
and it's golden, and I'm just not giving it up for nothing.
Those are his words, not our characterization, other than with regard to the bleep.
U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald. He described the stuff about the Senate seat as the most cynical behavior in all this, the most appalling. It's certainly what riveted the nation, to the extent that Blagojevich became a recurring character on Saturday Night Live.
Governor, yesterday you were impeached by the state legislature 114-1.
Yeah, it's closer than I thought.
But the Obama Senate seat was just one part of the criminal case. There were also allegations of shakedowns for campaign contributions. Ultimately, however, those were not the only trespasses that got Blagojevich impeached. The House of Representatives also detailed his disregard for the separation of powers, his mismanagement of state programs, and allegations that he violated hiring laws. But even all that, I would argue, is not Blagojevich's deepest scar on Illinois government. State Representative Jim Durkin, now the House Republican leader, he's the one who was in bed when he learned of the arrest, he is on the same page.
What he did to the finance of the state during a very important time, to me, was as bad as the crimes that he was convicted of.
You see, Blagojevich loved announcing expensive new programs, but he never got around to properly funding them.
You know, it's one thing if you don't want to raise taxes, but then you should, you know, cut spending to match what your revenue is. And if you want to expand programs, then you need to maybe raise revenue to fund it. And he just didn't do.
He didn't do either. He talked about, you know, I balanced the budget. You know, what they did is that they balanced the budget by skipping pension payments. I mean, this is where it started.
All that left Illinois in a weak position when the Great Recession hit, and in many ways we're still struggling to get out from under some of those bad decisions. At least that's my view.
I wish we could blame the state's fiscal woes on a character like Blagojevich. I don't think that's necessarily fair.
State Senator Don Harmon is a Democrat from Oak Park. He was driving when he got the news.
My mother called me and said they were reporting on WGN the governor had just been arrested.
Harmon says he was no friend of Blagojevich. He thinks it was his bill banning campaign contributions from state contractors that led to the governor's scramble for cash at the end of 2008. Harmon says another of the Blagojevich sins was that he politicized absolutely everything.
He didn't make decisions based on good public policy. He made them based on politics. You can accuse people around this building of that sort of decision-making all the time, but he took it to a different level, I think.
Forget talk of bipartisanship. Blagojevich never figured out how to work with people on his own side. And as Illinois returns to one-party Democratic rule next year, the importance of building those relationships is something it could pay to remember. I'm Brian Mackey.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There is growing support for career-focused education in high schools, including state and federal funding. Jobs are available in technical fields and skilled trades. But in this college application season, some business groups and educators say getting students to consider options outside of college is still a challenge. Illinois Newsroom's Mary Hansen reports.
On a recent Tuesday afternoon, a few high school students are measuring and cutting siding. They're building a house in the construction trades class at the Capital Area Career Center in Springfield, often referred to as CACC. Shelby Landers is one of the students hammering siding onto the front of the house.
I'm learning this so I could go out and work for a construction company and do something with carpentry or pick up a new trade after high school.
Landers says some of his classmates at Auburn High School, where he spends the mornings in class, don't get it.
Like, even back at my school, they think, unless they go to CA, we're not very bright and stuff because we come here.
Part of the reason is that he doesn't plan to go to college. Getting the job he wants in carpentry or machine operation would mean getting a union apprenticeship instead. There's increasing support from both the federal and state government for programs like the one at CACC. The goal is to prep students for a job or more training after high school in fields that need skilled workers. But supporters say one persistent challenge is the laser focus on preparing kids for college, overcoming the idea that college is always the best option.
Parents come in and say, my kid don't want to go to college. And when they said it like it was a bad thing.
Wes Amer is principal at Capital Area Career Center. He says he has to make the case that it isn't.
Not every kid is cut out to go to college. That this is what they want to do. This is their passion, and we need to support that passion. And that passion can lead to a great career, no college debt. Typically, a $25 to $30 an hour job that's going to be able to support a family, so that's okay.
There is data to support the focus on earning a college degree. On average, workers with a degree make more than those without. But Kate Kramer says demand for skilled workers is growing. She's deputy director of Advanced CTE. It's a national advocacy group for career and technical education programs like the one in Springfield.
The workforce and the labor force is changing so rapidly, and there are so many new opportunities and new sectors and new careers.
To help students find those new opportunities, the education system is trying to change too. Eugene Phillips is one example. He's studying computer networking at CACC, not to find a job right out of high school, but to help figure out which job is right for him.
So when I was younger, I've always been programming. I've always been messing around, taking like PlayStations apart and things like that. When I was in middle school, I built my computer, and I still use it to this day.
The 18-year-old has already earned an industry-recognized certificate that would qualify him for some cybersecurity jobs. And those jobs continue to grow. Industry estimates put the number of needed workers at almost 2 million worldwide by 2022. But for Phillips, he's picked both technical training and college. He plans to get a bachelor's degree and maybe eventually a master's.
Having that degree will open up doors for me that I don't have without a degree.
Kramer, with the National Advocacy Group, says it's key for high schools to present a variety of options.
The shift that needs to happen is, why are you going to college? How does that fit into your career pathway? Which program actually makes sense for you? And making the most of that. So going to post-secondary with an informed decision, not just defaulting into it.
As parents and students think about what comes after high school, she says discussions need to include all the options, not just college. I'm Mary Hansen, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration covering education, politics, health, and the environment. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, made possible with listener contributions. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The new album from Roots Rockers The Bottle Rockets explores technology and other changes that have occurred since the band formed in 1992. The St. Louis-based quartet appears at the Castle Theater tonight. Drummer and band co-founder Mark Ortman tells GLT's John Norton the band also wants to focus the album musically on an outlaw country sound.
Yeah, you know, the band's always had country songs on our records from the first album. But this time we really focused on it and intentionally made more of a country or an outlaw country album. We figured we'd been kind of labeled an Americana band for so long, we might as well do an Americana record.
Well, and the record Bit Logic is about change, but it's also, to me, it's about, you know, dang it, we're hitting a certain age now, and we're going to talk about what that means.
Right. Well, there's a certain element of old dogs learning new tricks, as Brian says, regarding that song. But it definitely is a look at society now and coping with how to dealing and with how to living in it. You know, every generation has its new frontiers and things to deal with. And we're at the stage now where we're trying to just navigate these difficult times. And society is just a whole different place right now.
Well, let's go to one of the songs on the album, and it's called Lo-Fi.
Al Green in the kitchen on the AM radio. Best bad sound that I ever did know. Scratchy and it's muddy, but it carries me through. Straight on down to Memphis in 72.
I remember I did that. My mom used to have this, write this little radio on the refrigerator of the kitchen. You could go back from back and forth from the higher tone on it or the lower tone on it. But
right. That's considered high tech at the time, right? It sounds like you and we are of the same age because we had the same thing when we were kids. You know, our mom would have the AM radio on in the kitchen while she's making dinner or a meal, whatever. And that was the music of the time. AM radio was mixed a certain way, too, where it was the music was in mono. It was mixed to sound really good on a car radio, so it really carried well.
Now, back when I was young, the way to go was listening to records
on my stereo. I was all about the quality. I was all about the tone. Now I'm happy hearing music on my telephone.
Many of us back then weren't kind of nutty about the fidelity, right? We had to have the perfect stereos, and now, as the song says, now we just listen to music through our phones.
Phones and earbuds, you know, the speakers the size of a dime or smaller, and people are satisfied. They don't know any different, so that's what they're raised on, and that's what they accept. Now, there are people out there who are audiophiles, and they have the big home system, and vinyl actually has a resurgence these days, nowhere even close to digital downloads or streaming. But the fact that they're still making really good vinyl now and reissuing that, it's encouraging.
We're talking with Mark Ortman from the Bottle Rockets at the Castle Theater on Friday night. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. You know, I hadn't thought of it this way before, but because people are listening to music through their phones, and you just said their earbuds, when you record an album, do you take that into account?
Sort of. The producer that we use is super savvy about that in modern technology. So we actually kind of combine a digital recording with some analog technology as well. But in the end, it all ends up on a digital format. Even if you make an analog recording, it'll get mixed down or mastered digitally. So there's always that break in the chain. It's never true from the field to the table, so to speak, of a true analog chain. So you have to take all that into consideration. We're not necessarily focusing on just the digital realm, but you have to kind of weigh all the options. Well, if we do this, now we'll have to do that later. One of those kind of technical recording tricks, you know.
Well, Mark Ortman with the Bottle Rockets, our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. I like the juxtaposition of the name of the album, Bit Logic, with, and you were referencing going back to outlaw country music on this album, and Bad Time to Be an Outlaw is one of the songs on the album. So you're kind of going back in time to be an outlaw while you're going forward with the Bit Logic of the album. But I want to play just a little bit of this song.
It's a bad time to be an outlaw. But she can afford it when shit breaks down. It's a bad time to be an outlaw.
And I know you're getting a lot of questions about some of these lyrics. Carrie Underwood don't make country sound, but she can afford when, you know, stuff breaks down. Brian Henneman has said that you don't have a beef with today's pop country stars, but you guys aren't pop country. You are alt country, you're outlaw country, and that's where your comfort zone is, right?
Yeah, more or less, I suppose. Outlaw country. That, you know, back in the day, back in the 70s, you had Waylon Jennings, Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, all those guys doing it. It's kind of a different thing than it is now, because right now it's all retro if you're doing that. But we grew up on Waylon Jennings. Take that as an influence this time and focus on it and make it more of an obvious influence. Like I said earlier, all these things have always been there in our music. It's just that this time made it obvious that those are influenced.
Well, as you mentioned, Mark, this is a going back to talk about how times have changed a little bit. And when you're writing about the past on an album like this, what is it about the past that's an inspiration for this?
Well, the past always affects the future. That's just one way of looking at it. You know, yesterday affects today. It is an acknowledgement of our current state. It's a combination of taking old styles or old influences and then acknowledging them now and updating them to the moment.
All this instant information and virtual reality are clear. Vanishes as quick as it appears. You best be looking out the windshield, not the mirror, to figure out the way to go from here.
Mark Ortman with the Bottle Rockets here on GLT Sound Ideas. I'll put you on the spot. An interview about 5 years ago in No Depression, your bandmate and fellow co-founder Brian Henneman said there would be no Bottle Rockets without Mark Ortman. Well, since Brian's not here to answer the question, what does he mean by that?
Well, I think we're just too stupid to stop. I know Brian has been discouraged with the band along the way during his 25-year history, so there were times he wanted to get out. And there were times both of us thought, man, this is enough. You know, where do you draw the line? Where do you cut your losses? But neither of us at the time ever were in that place at the same time, so the band never officially broke up. And as long as I'm willing to do it, Brian means that he's willing to do it. And at this point, we're both willing to do it. So that's why the band never broke up. And that's why he said that about me, I suppose.
You guys have been together, is it 25 years now? A little bit more than that?
Yeah, over 25 now. It's been a long haul, as the Bottle Rockets.
When you guys came together, what were your dreams back then, and how have you reconciled that with how it's actually played out?
Well, you know, you have to change as you go along and adjust with reality. When you start out, you know, we wanted to be Fog Hat with our name on the side of the tail of the plane, you know, be the Rolling Stones, be fantastic. But when that didn't happen, you know, you recognize it, and you learn along the way how to not settle for less, but to just adjust your goals with reality. And with that said, we're very happy with where we are because we love what we're doing. And when you do something original and creative, it's very limited sometimes in its scope. It's not everyone may like it. So you have to find a way to find your audience and then connect with them. So we're doing what we enjoy and making a living at it, and I couldn't be happier.
Bottle Rockets drummer and co-founder Mark Ortman, speaking with GLT's John Norton. The St. Louis-based quartet appears at the Castle Theater tonight. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and John Norton. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. Will I ever get to use my cruise? Hey, will I ever get to use my cruise? I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.